This is, I forgot to say all this. This is week, or third session, second week. My name is Ruth Hanusa. That's for the tape's benefit. Ruth Hanusa. I'm a co-pastor with my husband in Carson City, Nevada. We have one full-time call, which we split, and we have three preschoolers whose care we also split, more or less in half. This morning, I want to look at two sections in Luke, two stories in Luke, and if they go the whole hour, that's fine. If not, I'll haul out a couple more in chapter 7, and we'll look at those. The stories that I'm looking at, that we'll look at today, are stories that I kind of find captivating. But I'm going to tell you beforehand that the way I tell them or the way I interpret them isn't necessarily definitive. The telling that I have now, often I got little snippets of ideas from other places, and that opened it up for me. But something else may open it up for you, and that's really the point of the story, is that you feel a part of it and connect with it somehow. So, be bold about, good on dreams, right? Be bold about doing your own interpretations here. First one begins with verse 25. This is the gospel lesson for Pentecost, eighth Sunday of Pentecost in cycle C. So you'll be hearing about a year from now in your churches. It begins, "And behold, a lawyer stood up to put him to the test, to put Jesus to the test, saying, 'Teacher,'" you know, if you're going to ask a nasty question, you always polish it a little bit first. "Good teacher," he doesn't say it good here, but "what shall I do to inherit eternal life?" And Jesus said to him, "Well, what is written in the law? How do you read it?" And the lawyer said, he memorized in confirmation class and never forgot it, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." Simple. And Jesus said to him, "You have answered right. Do this and you will live." 29. "But he," the lawyer, "desiring to justify himself," there's a key there, "said to Jesus, 'And who is my neighbor?'" That's always a question we have to ask too. Who's our neighbor? Jesus replied with this story. "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, a notoriously bad road." Thieves along there, and it was not a safe road to travel. If you could, you would take the interstate that bypassed it, but it was out. So the guy had to take this particular road, and it was just in rotten shape. And they've been talking for years about getting a committee together to improve the road for travelers, but they just hadn't gotten that together yet. And so this particular man fell among some of these robbers, who stripped him and beat him and departed, leaving him half dead. Now, by chance, a priest was going down that road, hurrying off to the hospital to care for a parishioner in intensive care. And when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. So likewise a Levite, who was going to be on teaching staff at Holden Village and was rushing to make the boat because there's only one a day, and when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, one of those hated, rotten, godless Samaritans, as he journeyed, came to where he was. He was a rich Samaritan, by the way, and he had one of these fancy new cars with plush, that plush stuff they put in cars, you know. Not the plastic, but the cloth seats, that's what he had. Driving by, and he sees this guy in the ditch flashing his flashlight up. And he knew that it was just a ruse. Perhaps it was really somebody, one of these robbers, who was just playing the game. I mean, he'd read the papers, and he knew about living defensively. But nevertheless, when he saw him, he had compassion. And he went to him and bound up his wounds, pouring on oil and wine, and put him on his new car seats, and he was bloody and yucky. Then he set him, well, then we can skip the beast part, can't we? He takes him to, not an inn, but to an hospital, which they named Good Samaritan later on in his honor. And the next day, he stays all night while the surgery team's working on him. The next morning, he gives him his credit card, and he says, "Whatever you need, just pay for it out of this, and I'll come back in a little while and pick up the card." "Which of these three," Jesus asked the lawyer, "do you think proved neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers?" And he said, "The one who showed mercy on him." And Jesus said, "Go and do likewise." Now, who do you think of, if you take that story, and we're going to do a little play here, what part would you pick to play? What kind of Where does your personality match up? Which of these characters in this story? Anywhere from 25, actually.
I hate to say it, but I would have known Levi.
Okay.
Because we were taking high school kids last May, you know, 3 months ago up here, and there was a car turned backwards on the Highway 18 going up to the interstate, and where we had was 15 high school kids down the street in the back of the van, and obviously the person that was dead, it was all over the place. My husband wanted to stop. No! Don't stop, we'll miss the boat, we'll all these kids. So we did the second best thing, we stopped at the state patrol here on the path and told them, and then they went back. But I wouldn't even want to do that. I didn't want to miss this boat.
Okay. Any other confessions? Priests, Levites, and...
This is 4 in the morning, by the way.
Well, then you aren't quite as bad.
No,
then,
no, no, no. How rotten it was for them.
Any other? Let me tell you a story. Oh, go ahead.
I'd probably relate to the beast.
The beast.
Yeah, I'd be willing to be an accomplice, but I might not be the initiator. And so... If someone needed help, I'd be willing to help out, but I don't
want to
jump in
first. Oh, I hadn't heard that one before. That's good. When I was living in Arlington Heights, back in 73, I think it was, I was at a deaconess intern at this rather fat cat church, and we had to drive around all these hospitals, and I had to go into Park Ridge. And I was on my way to visit a parishioner, and I was at a stoplight, and it was hot, like end of August, early September, and so I had all the windows of the car rolled down. And I was at this light, and this man approaches the car with a suitcase, opens the door, puts a suitcase in the back seat, and gets in. And I didn't know what to do. I mean, what do you do? You're sitting there with your car running, waiting for the light to change, and somebody gets in your car. And well, you know, gosh, I was one of these really good goody-two-shoes. And so here's my chance to be the Good Samaritan, right? So I said, well, what did he want? Well, he was an alcoholic. He needed to be taken to a treatment program. And I said, what? Where? I mean, I hardly knew the area. Well, Park Ridge had one. Or Lutheran General. Yeah, Lutheran General in Park Ridge, yeah. So I took him there, took him back to the emergency entrance, and they didn't seem to make much to do about him. I mean, they were busy, and I kind of got the impression that he'd been there before a lot. I mean, just the attitude of the nurses was kind of, well, just let him wait. He kind of lives here, almost. You know, and so they were hemming and hawing around, and that wasn't going to work. Well, then he said he would need to get to an AA meeting, and I didn't know where they met. And he said, well, they meet at churches sometimes. And I said, well, I know one Lutheran church in the area. So I drove him there, and he got out, and I drove off real fast. This all took about an hour or so. And I went home, and I was just an absolute wreck. I just felt devastated by this experience, you know. Here I'd left him, because I just got tired of him finally, and I couldn't figure out what to do with him anyway. And so I just left him. Besides, I had to do a Bible study the next morning for the youth, and I was worried about that. So there goes, you know, your security. But what I did the next day then for the Bible study is I told them this story as though it was a friend of mine, and then had them play with the meaning of this story. What's it mean, you know? Do you pick up hitchhikers? And I was fearful their parents were all going to get down my throat in a day. You know, it looks as though he stopped and assisted somebody that was in a dangerous position. Sometimes I have seen cars in the ditch at night, and you see lights that are flying up like this, so you know it's not just a car with lights out of alignment. It really, you know, and driven by, fearful that it was just a ruse. And I don't know if the Good Samaritan was in any safer a position. This road was notorious. It was really unsafe. And why couldn't a robber have been fooling then as they do now? You know, I'm sure there's much psychology going on then as now.
Just after breakfast, we were thinking the same thing. Ever since I was very young, my parents kept telling me, well, you know, you don't take candy from strangers. You don't associate with people. And you're very standoffish. You're very suspicious. And all you grow up, you know, always thinking the worst.
Mm-hmm.
Then you come to Holden Village and they say, well, look for the face of God in a stranger's face. And to me, that's just the opposite. You see, you know, you're supposed to be looking for the good people. And always before you're brought up to be suspicious or really be thinking seriously about these people. You don't let your guard down.
Mm-hmm.
And you come here and you don't have keys to any room. Everything was wide open. And you feel safe, you feel good. It's neat to go and and feel like everyone is loving and caring. It's completely different.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know, there's two sides.
Yeah.
And I really feel, you know, kind of right in the middle right now. It's a good feeling, but
it
doesn't always happen that way. So when you try to be the Good Samaritan, sometimes you wonder what's going to happen to me.
Yeah.
You get here and you know, you can put that behind you. I don't know. But there is, it's different. When you leave here, how long is it going to take me to go back to my other way of thinking?
Go to the Stahican, they don't have any keys there, and the schoolhouse was open. You walk in, look at the artwork they left there over the summer, and people are, I mean, it's, I think it's being away from a lot of this driving traffic.
Yeah.
Might make it out. I think it's wonderful you can leave a camera or a Bible or a cross pin out here for 3 days and it stays right where you are.
Or even your child. Someone's. Someone said to me, at least you don't need to be worried about them being molested here if you aren't watching them every second. That's true, I don't worry about that. I do worry about them getting down the river and drowning and falling off the coin in the balcony, however. But I don't worry about them being molested. What, I saw a hand somewhere, didn't I?
I scratched my ear.
Oh, pardon. How about that person?
Yeah, I had a flat tire on a busy highway and with a friend, and stood there, you know, two gray-haired ladies, and I was just so glad that somebody did see us and actually went up the freeway ways and took a turnaround and came around to help. You know,
mm-hmm.
I was awfully grateful that someone trusted us and helped us.
Those are safe calls.
Well, yeah, I guess I'm be afraid of
this. I'm sometimes afraid that somebody is going to stop you.
Oh!
I had car trouble once. We lived north of the San Fernando Valley, kind of out in the desert area. And I had two small children with me, and the car broke down, and it was like a mile and a half to the nearest gas station. And so I started walking, and one of them was not walking, and the other one was a toddler. We started up the road. And I really didn't want anybody.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's a terrible thing.
I'm afraid
of other people.
I've known that too. Running out of gas about 11 o'clock at night on the Oakland freeway. You know? Real smart. And then fill up before you leave San Francisco. It's a long drive. Somebody stopped and I got in with them. But I knew that was a little dangerous.
The ultimate loss of your life?
Ultimate loss is your life, yeah. Or maybe what you have to go through in losing it, you know. Go ahead.
It's more real than we sometimes realize. Our neighbor's daughter was transporting a car for a rental company and had car trouble. And she had somebody else with her, but they happened to be in front of her. And she had help, but she didn't live to come back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it was the wrong person who stopped.
Yeah. Were you afraid of anybody stopping to help
Not
you?
Not really. I held out my hand.
Did you expect?
I need help.
Did you expect anyone to stop?
Sure.
You did.
A lot of cars went by.
Yeah.
But the people who stopped were kind and helped me put the little false thing on,
yeah.
Got in its town where I could get it fixed.
Or, yeah.
I really wasn't afraid.
Yeah.
It was broad daylight.
Yeah. Did you expect anybody to stop? I mean, you were fearful they might, but did you expect, I guess, a good person to stop, to help you, someone who wouldn't hurt you?
I don't think so. I don't remember.
Anybody been in a ditch situation where you didn't expect anybody to stop because it just was really unsafe? I wonder if this guy in the ditch expected anybody to stop for him. I mean, he knew how dangerous that road was. And maybe as the Samaritan approached in his fancy car, he was worried too. I mean, maybe the Samaritan wasn't a good guy. Besides, he was a hated Jew. Anybody?
I know that we
been in the pits, or you know.
We had a sermon talking about it being the most reviled person you ever know coming to help you. Here is your favorite pastor walking by, or maybe a newscaster, someone you knew on TV that you really respected walking by. Here's someone you not liked ever in your life, and mm-hmm. they stop and give you mercy.
Mm-hmm.
And how would you feel then?
Mm-hmm.
Your own attitude in the ditch.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes when you're in real need, some of those things change. And if you're really in need, you don't question.
Yeah.
And that's maybe good or bad.
Yeah. But I bet he didn't expect it. And I guess that's the surprise of this story. That when you remember a time when you've been in the ditch and nobody, you really couldn't expect anybody to help you because you wouldn't have been in the same situation. And then somebody good comes along who not only doesn't further molest you, but takes you out and then covers your expenses for the whole thing. I mean, you don't have to find a lawyer to start a suit or anything. I think that's the real power. Go ahead.
Yeah, given again, I think we're talking about stereotypes here. You know, and that's one of the lessons Christ was trying to teach you. And we've said here quite a few times that the fear that we have of the person who stops or to stop in a situation like that, I really think the fear is a tool of Satan. And you know, you read through the Psalms, and David says, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of shadow of death, I will fear no evil."
Yeah.
And to, you know, the goal is to completely put our trust in Christ, as mm-hmm. he did, you know, as we looked in the book of Mark the last couple of days, where he says, "I'm going to Jerusalem, and they're going to put it to me."
Mm-hmm.
But I don't, you know, I didn't hear any fear in Christ's voice, and, you know, that's one of the lessons that Christ wants to teach you. Not only care for your neighbor, but don't be afraid of what that situation is going to bring, because I'll take you through it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That sounds great, except that if you're a single woman, it's not always the safe thing to do. If I were in trouble, even if I were alone and had three kids and the car was stuck by the side of the road, I wouldn't expect another woman to stop and help me. I would be mad if a great big burly truck driver drove by. Because he could handle the situation, he wouldn't have anything to fear from me. But for me to stop for a truck driver, it would be trouble. You know, it seems to be a situational kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think one thing Christ is saying here, let's drop your stereotypes. Let's forget about what they show on TV and with to sensationalize some of these situations. And
yeah.
Maybe that's be more trusting of people.
Sure, trusting of people, you think? Do you think that's what the message is here?
I think that's one of the messages. It's care. The obvious one is care.
Yeah.
But also trusting each other.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, how many times right here in the village have we had minor needs? And can I help you? Oh, no, that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And we do it all through society. You bump into somebody, excuse me, I didn't mean to touch you. And I think there's a basic lack of trust in all of that.
Mm-hmm.
I had a similar situation to yours where a woman, when my car would stop at a stop, I'm moving on crutches. Somewhere I'd open my car door and climb in the back seat and said she wanted to go to the University Hospital. And I was so stunned that
you just do it.
And I was kind of shaking, like, you wondering what did I do afterwards. And when she got out, she said thank you and she got out. And I thought she could have hit me with her crutches or done something if she had been in the mood.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought afterwards, well, she must have seen something in my face. And I was the person she could trust to take her home.
What? Oh, I'm sorry.
Isn't the story here of being sent to do something you don't want to do? In Stephen ministry, every once in a while, you have to go and into a situation, both going to a grief situation, crisis situation is tremendously hard on me to begin with.
Yeah.
Going to do it with someone who I have no respect for or don't want to, that's, I think, what happened here.
Yeah.
He was sent, if the Samaritan would have gone to help the Samaritan in that situation, that's one thing. He was being sent to help somebody who hated him with a passion.
Okay.
And so it's almost a little more than some of our situations.
Yeah, yeah. So Jesus is encouraging, or well, he really is telling us to be like Good Samaritans.
I was wondering why we don't show compassion, you know, why all of a sudden we stop. In this situation, I think about, instead we stop and analyze why that person is there instead of the fact that they have a need.
Yeah.
And we're called to minister to people's needs.
Uh-huh.
And instead we say, well, he's an alcoholic, my goodness. No wonder he's in this situation. Or no wonder he has a broken leg.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead we start judging the person mm-hmm. for why they're in their situation instead of seeing there's a need. We're called to minister mm-hmm. to people's needs.
Mm-hmm.
And then just go with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. we aren't done with this, but I'm going to take you into the next pericope. I think that they inform one another. Verse 38. This, by the way, is the gospel lesson for Cycle C, Pentecost 9, Ninth Sunday of Pentecost. They are read two consecutive Sundays. Now, as they went their way, he entered a village, Jesus, and a woman named Martha received him into her house. And she had a sister called Mary, who sat at the Lord's feet and listened to his teaching. But Martha was distracted with much serving, and she went to him and said, "Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to serve alone? Tell her then to help me." Imagine if you'd be a guest in somebody's home, and they come trotting out and say, the woman comes out and says, "Would you tell my no good so-and-so husband to get in here and help me? You know, order him around." I mean, that could be real embarrassing, couldn't it, if you were a guest? Unless they were maybe very, very good friends. But the Lord answered her, "Martha, Martha, you are anxious and troubled about many things. One thing is needful. Mary has chosen the good portion, which will not be taken away from her." A kind of classical interpretation of this, or a number of them, is that these have been kind of pitted as poles apart. On the one hand, women should be passive and sit at the feet of men and listen, and on the other hand, they should be in the kitchen cooking. And some churches have kitchens far more larger and more elaborate than Holden Village that feeds, you know, 400 people three times a day. So those have been kind of pitted against each other. And also, sometimes it has been interpreted as you need to be passive. You know, it's better to go to a Bible study than entertain your friends, you know, in that kind of comparative thing. Let me tell you how I see Martha, though. Jesus comes in, he's a bit earlier than he said he would, and she's running a bit behind with things. And got more than one Martha in the room. And she's out there in the kitchen, and she's bustling around, and she's getting frantic, and she puts her foot in the cat's water and spills it all over the floor, and then she breaks a bowl because she bangs it against the sink, and then she burns herself on the stove, and she's slamming the pots and pans and banging the doors and getting more and more furious, and that stupid sister of hers never helps. She always was lazy. She always sat and read books whenever there was work to be done besides Mom liked her best. She's storming around in there, and she's not saying anything, but the noise level is getting louder and louder and louder and louder. And Jesus comes out the kitchen, opens up the fridge. That's right. Mary and Martha were Germans. Takes out a beer and hands it to Martha and says, "Come on, Martha, come in here and sit a spell. Forget about dinner. We'll call Dominic's and they deliver." Domino's pizza, they deliver. It wasn't wrong what Martha was doing. It is not a bad thing to serve. That was Semitic hospitality, and women, that was their job to do, to provide lavish meals for their guests. And she was only doing her duty, only doing what was expected of her. And that was expected of Martha, too. Mary wasn't doing it. The problem with Martha serving is not that she's serving. He never puts her down for serving. He never puts her down at all. Never puts her down. But she was distracted with the serving. She lost her focus. Jesus came there to feed her. She wanted to nurture and feed him. She was a woman, he was a man, that was the way things were supposed to be. What he was trying to tell her, what he wanted her to see, and what he implies Mary sees, is that he is the server, he's the servant, he's there to feed her, to be her benefactor, to give to her. And once she has received from him, then she can go about her serving. The way to be a better Martha is to first be a Mary. These women should not be pulled apart as two opposites. You should or you shouldn't, or one is better and one is worse, or you do this now or this now. They really belong together. They are sisters, these notions of being active and passive here. But the passivity is sitting and drinking deep from Jesus first, feeding on his flesh and drinking his blood, in a sense. And knowing that gift, knowing what that gift is. Then when you do your serving, it's not because you have to do it or because it's your job. You see, Martha was a slave to the situation here. She was a slave to the tradition. And she saw her sister as a slave to that tradition too. And Jesus' job as master was to keep all the slaves in order. Line them up and march them out, Jesus. That's what we want. Law and order here. The obligation that comes with this radical new age that Danker describes Jesus bringing in. Jesus brings in the new age. Is that there is the obligation to be free of our slavery. Obligation to be free of our slavery. That's the response. Let me read what he says. He says it so nicely. Let's see. They have the. He's talking about both rich and poor. Rich are to reevaluate their power over the lives of others, and the less are not to seek how quickly they can put the others in their debt. On the contrary, they have the responsibility of being liberated so that they too can become liberators, to repent of the love of slavery, to repent of our fear of speaking words of power to power, to repent of slavish adherence to tradition, to repent of all that satisfies us for the moment but forges chains for others who come after. This is to be the response of the proclamation, the obligation to be free. That is part of the message of the radical gospel of the New Age. Mary was learning about that, the responsibility to be free, and Martha still needed to learn it, and that's what Jesus is there to teach her, that she has a responsibility to respond out of having drunk deep of him, of eaten at his feet, in a sense, and out of that respond to it. At first glance, it looks as though Martha's the Good Samaritan, right? Bustling around, doing the right thing, seeing the need, picking up. I think Martha really parallels this lawyer who's trying to justify himself. That's what Martha's doing in this story. She's trying to justify herself as a good hostess, as a woman in good standing. And Mary is the potential Good Samaritan. It's Mary who's first drinking deep from Jesus. I want to say again that this is in no way a put down of serving or of hospitality. I think being able to give the gift of hospitality is one of the most gracious gifts you can give. And it doesn't mean that it's just that you have a nice big house and you have fancy wine glasses and you have champagnes too and all the stuff you're supposed to have for entertaining. You can do it very simply with just a bottle of or box of wine and little orange juice glasses.
I think that for me the story is good because when I entertain, sometimes it's easier to hide in the kitchen.
Yeah.
You know, you've invited all your friends over. You're in control in the kitchen.
Yes.
In the kitchen and get all that stuff cleaned up and I don't socialize and I have to remember I invited people because I wanted to see them too. And so not the Martha in me. And I think we both have Martha and Mary Dennis.
Right.
And
right.
One is out more than the other at different times in our life. But mm-hmm. We just have to be aware of that.
Yeah.
Why didn't Jesus say two things are needful? According to your view, it seems that there's two things that are needful. He's got to give them the right order. But he says one thing is needful, and Mary has chosen the right one.
Well, yeah.
I understand that.
Well, I think, you know, that if we start saying two things are needful and you got to get them in priorities, then your great sin is that you ain't got your priorities right. And I think that we do that sometimes. We do that in the church. We talk about people giving money, you know, haven't got their priorities right, like I do. By saying one thing needful, I think he squarely dumps us all in the ditch is what he does. Squarely puts us all in the ditch. That's where we all, the only way to be good Samaritans is to be first in the ditch. To know you've been in the ditch and nobody, maybe you're even a robber who was robbed by robbers. Maybe that even heightens it. And that you've been rescued by a good Samaritan. Lo and behold, this guy who approaches you, this stinky smelly guy, is Jesus who rescues you. And as soon as we take our focus off that with the two things, I think it can dull it, you know. If you know what it is to be in the ditch and to have been surprised by grace, you will serve. You will be a good Samaritan, even in spite of ourselves, I think, sometimes.
Well, the one thing that's needful is not Mary sit there learning from Jesus, but having been in the ditch yourself.
Well, I think, Mary, I'm sure Mary knew the tradition, too. She knew what she was expected to do, and she wasn't bothering to help at all. You know, what if she was reading comic books? isn't helping, you know? What if Mary was lazy? Maybe she really was lazy and Mom really did like her best, you know? That may be true, too. I'm kind of swaffling here and off the point, but...
I think, you know, Christ says there's one thing you need. I've got a reference there in Psalm 27, verse 4. And it says that one thing I ask of the Lord, this is what I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord, to seek him in his temple. That's the one thing that's needed. You could fast.
Yeah.
You don't need to have a meal. Yeah. You need to have the Lord.
Maybe this could be tied in with Galatians passage and Paul's letter to the Galatians. The one thing that is needful to the Galatians is that they have the gospel. And if there are the two things that are needful, that brings in that the whole question of circumcision, because that's kind of the seal of who you are. And Paul reminds us people know that as attractive, even a stronger word than attractive, as attractive as obeying these laws may seem, whatever those laws are, whether it's good stewardship or being circumcised or following the traditions of the fathers, that is not needful. That if any of that happens, it's a natural response, if that makes any sense, a natural response to the appropriation of the gospel.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Does it to you, Ron? Are you playing off Kierkegaard, I suppose? Wonder why. Why do you do that?
I think it's one of the variations on that one line. I always find the text interesting that I've been tampered with. The variation is, what Mary has chosen is more needful.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's not the one needful thing. But
who has that? Sina Iticus or Alexandrinus?
Guys, one of those guys that couldn't speak Norwegian. I don't know. But that seems to me that, you know, again, that makes you a classic reading of the text, and that's the center of it all, trying to get straight what this word of Jesus is to Martha.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, there's another interpretation. I wish I'd read it more recently so that I could give it fully, but I think it was Eckhart, or Meister Eckhart, that around that time there was a whole, like a cult of Martha, in which it was a real feminist movement. And I think that the interpretation was, Mary has chosen the good part. Ah, only the part, though. Martha has it all together. and I thought the interpretation is Martha as the mature woman sort of trying, Jesus saying, be patient with this little sister of yours who really doesn't have it all together yet. And it's really interesting to read. I think that that's in The Women Around Jesus by Elizabeth Maltman Wendell. But anyway, it's a very interesting...
Huh. I hadn't heard that one. I hadn't heard that one. Go ahead.
I think that there is a kind of corollary for us, especially those of us who live in cities where every day we go downtown and see new people who are going to move down to the street, and they're dirty and they stink and they often smell alcohol, and they tell us they're hungry. They need something, and everything I've been taught is these people are nutrients, ignore them. If you give them money, they'll take their whole wallet, things like that. And if Jesus says one thing is needful, then I think he calls us in those difficult situations to risk feeling naive and to risk our fear, and to let go of all that Martha-type stuff that we've been told and trained to do. So let go of that and let Jesus feed awful-looking people to us.
Any other?
I can't help but think what I'm hearing that the situation we have in Carson City, where the churches have banded together and formed an organization called FISH, Friends in Service Helping, in order to take care of trainers, and there are a fair number of them in that. And part of that, the reason for that, is to weed out those who, one newsletter came in saying so-and-so came through in spring of 81 and spring of 82 and spring of 83 and has been using fish as kind of their host. Put them up in a motel and get food. And I am acutely aware that one of the main things, maybe the, from my viewpoint, best thing that happens with fish is I can say, golly, we don't have any money here for you. We give to fish, and if you want to get anything done, you know, go to fish, which takes all the responsibility off of me to choose whether this person needs the money or not. Yeah, go fish. Right, go fish. And I am really aware of what I'm doing and glad that I can do it because it is so hard deciding who gets the money because the truth of the matter is that there is only so many resources going around. And if you give too much to this person, then, now this may seem, I can hear the argument coming back. But if you give too much to this person and somebody else down the line who may really need it, it's going to be shortchanged just out of it. Or the one person will, and I'm sure that other people in the congregation here who have experience in congregations know that one person may call First Pres, Bethlehem Lutheran, St. Teresa's, Roman Catholic, all asking for the $10 for the gasoline to get out of town. It sounds funny, but it's a terrible fix to be put in. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Anytime you serve the Lord, you set yourself up to be abused. Mm-hmm. You know, let's face it, you're going to have to be ripped off sooner or later. Mm-hmm. And, but that's not a reason to get out. And maybe that person's returning again and again, not for the money, but maybe for someone to say, let's sit down and let's just talk about this. You become pretty familiar. Let's, you know, you want a relationship. Let's have a relationship. Mm-hmm.
Is there a parable about a con artist?
About a what?
A con artist. Because, boy, I deal with a lot of con artists on a monthly basis.
Is after yesterday's session, there a guy, I don't know, the guy who gave that alternate interpretation, the blind man, are you here? I don't see him. He said it's the one in Mark, Timaeus, Bartimaeus, son of Timaeus. He says, you know, every time I hear this story, I see this guy as a great crowd worker, and he isn't blind at all. He has been working at the system all this time, and for some reason, when Jesus calls him up, he goes the whole way, and you know, it's 10 minutes after Jesus is out of town, he starts another racket. And I hadn't thought of that. I hadn't thought of that, but you know, maybe that even the fact that if that is the case, the story doesn't, I mean, you know, however it catches you, I guess. You know, if he decided to throw off his blindness at the point that he did, I mean, that's, well, no, that's maybe the most striking thing is that he does follow Jesus in the text. Even if he had been faking it all of these years, he follows Jesus, you know. And maybe it's better if we make the guy into a real rascal. You know, I think it heightens grace. Kristen.
I taught in the sales industry for many years, and one of the schools I was in, there was a man teacher. He was always very well dressed, and he was always talking about how he was always investing his money and this and that. Well, after I retired, I became more active in him helping him to the missionary project. And went down with my group one time to serve dinner at the Lutheran Compass Center, where they feed about 200 people and all, and a night. And they bring them up in shifts. And lo and behold, one of the shifts, this fellow comes up to get a free dinner. And I guess one of the gals that was with me is here today. I was confounded. I did not know whether to address him, and I'm sure he recognized me because he never once looked up after he said first time. I didn't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what my doing at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Because here we were on the same staff together, and lunch together, and we teach each other and everything. And here he comes up to the mission, and we're up in the right ragged and not
having it. Yeah. There are people who work the system. There's.
I'm thinking what she's talking about that. Maybe he's lonely, maybe he doesn't look at that. That's what I thought. I just forget it, and we all just incidental. That's why I was sorry I hadn't spoken to him, because maybe he was there for the fellowship. He was a loner. I felt guilty in several ways.
You know, that situation, the one about the gas again, kind of says maybe we should let these people play out their hands. That's what Christ did with Martha. It wasn't until Martha came in and asked him, Lord, tell her to get off the butt and get to work. And you know, at that point, then Christ could deal with the problem. But maybe let the people, you know, to commit yourself to establish a relationship, but then let that person bring up the problem. If you go to them and say, you've got this problem, that's not going to work.
Yeah. Somebody said in the early session, you know, that, you know, maybe it didn't embarrass Jesus to be asked this. Maybe that Martha maybe knew she was in trouble, not just with getting the meal prepared, but maybe she knew that her whole life seems to go this way. And really, you know, it was, even though it was a botched request in a sense, you know, maybe that's what it was. And that made me think that sometimes with our praying, we think we got to have all the words right, or some places, you know, you can't start the council meeting unless the pastor prays, you know. God forbid any of us have to do it. We couldn't do it right, you know. You know, at least there's some dialogue here, which I bet means that they were really good friends, and that she trusted Jesus to even begin to say, to even ask for help. And that picks up on, then he did, you know.
When I was in Israel last year, our very Jewish guide said, when we went through Bethany, she said, well, this Martha being able to write the way she did showed how close friends they were.
Yeah, yeah.
I've read that somewhere else.
Yeah, yeah. go ahead.
I'm wondering how the story ended. I think maybe Jesus and Mary picked up potato peelers and helped with the carrots, and they had a good time of fellowship and preparing them.
Maybe they did. Yeah.
But there can be fellowship in the prep time too, as well as just getting out.
Yeah. Go talk to your daddy. what we got into that this morning in the early session too, about how this can talk about the concrete situations of helping, of entertaining, you know. And I think there's a great variety of how that can happen for you. You know, you can work like mad till the company comes and then stop, you know, and sit down and have a glass of wine with them. Or you can be just real laid back. When they come, you just march them all in the kitchen and they help you. You know, all variety of things of how you decide to work it out, depending on who the Mary is you're living with, you know, and how far you get with griping and complaining and why won't you help me. Yeah, or maybe you just do dessert if it's a real tough time in your life, you can't do the full dinners, or, you know, how you all work it. I think what this story is not saying, and even what the Samaritan story is not saying, that there's a kind of stereotypical kind of behavior, that if you're going to be a good Samaritan, you got to stop for every person in the ditch. I think it's possible that the good Samaritan, or this guy when he got out of the ditch, never stopped for anybody in the ditch. That was just his particular phobia. Maybe he didn't. He, however, because he had been rescued from the ditch and knew the surprise and the aha of that experience, did finally get that committee going that did fix that Jericho road, make it safe for travelers. There are all different kinds of way to serve. And as Danker says, if the impulse is to be freed from the slavery, you know. If you find that the slavery is, well, the Jericho Road's always going to be unsafe, you know, why do you have to be in that? You know, is there power in here in having been rescued out of the ditch that enables you to do things that are unexpected, as the Good Samaritan does, you know? And I think the power's there. I think it is.
Don't you think that maybe this man who went by and helped this poor man had a gift, just like you have a gift for preaching, or somebody else has a gift for whatever, and so he used that particular gift that the Lord had given him. Don't you think some people are born with that gift? I have a brother who never passes anybody by, ever. He stops on his way up to Holden so some little kid could play with a rabbit, almost missed the boat. And he's just got that loving, giving. Now, Don said, you know, we were all taught to accept people. Mm-hmm. And I think we were. But somehow my brother missed the boat.
Yeah. The other side of that is, however, I love doing other side stuff, is that we can decide in advance we don't have a gift, and so never try, too, sometimes. That, you know, sometimes you can do that. There's a little book that we got from Jenny's Corner. It's about this mother mouse, and the rats are helping her move her house, but she has this special stone, and she has the courage to get on top of her house and pull it out of the mud because of her children are in there drowning. And, of course, the stone then lifts it all out, and there's magic in it. But what she says at the end is that something about courage is that you really don't need courage to help the ones you love. You don't always, it's not such extraordinary courage if you really care about someone. You jump in without thinking. And what happens with the guy in the ditch is that he is so surprised and so filled with love that he does start doing stuff that he wouldn't have done before and didn't have to do, wasn't obligated to do. Go.
I just wanted to say something about, not that I'm about being tough to mistrust people. You know, you get back what you respect to people, whether it's trust or distrust, and a perfect example of that is looking at kids. If you respect them to misbehave, most likely they will.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just assume that they're not going to, they're going to live up to a nice aspect. And you know, I think that carries true to life, respect the best in someone. Chances are it'll come true just so they're going to disappoint.
Yeah, my kids are more like 7 out of 10. I don't know. there is a relationship, though, on my mood and my state and theirs, though. I have seen that. When I'm really crabby, they pick up on it and they run with it. Do you think there's a difference between God-trusters and self-trusters? I mean, there's a difference, but can you see it? Can you always see when the Marthas are acting out of a sense of duty and obligation, or when they're acting out because they've first been Martha, or first been Mary? So you can tell. You say, can. Anybody else?
I always think when you are in a servant role, it's your attitude.
Okay.
You're either being stepped on, or you're doing it because you want to and you love doing it.
Can you be both at the same time?
Yes. Yes. I sure am.
Okay.
That's dying to self every day, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And why don't you love me?
Yeah.
One of the things I read about Martha, we have a pastor friend who likes to take the gospel stories, and he tells a conserving version and a radical version. The conserving version he does in all caps, and the radical with no caps. And he often turns stories on their head. Now, where is the Mary Martha one? What he says, this is what he says about a psychiatrist who talks to Martha. Martha is a good person to have around, all right. I've had her in therapy for 6 months now, and I have not only learned to understand her, I have learned to like her. She is a lot like me. One has to be a real driver to become a psychiatrist. A driver or a driven one. It's about the same, I guess. Anyway, Martha is that kind of person. Her parents taught her to produce the way mine taught me. Her parent, inside her, is still speaking in the conserving sermon above, about doing your duty. Only the specifics have changed. Now the parent is saying, get some of that divine word into your head. It's absolutely essential that you do so. Now go, if your life is before you, but do it right. I think we can misunderstand the message that what Mary needs to do is add Martha to her. And Jesus says, scrap the Martha part for a bit and start fresh with Mary. Jesus tells Martha that life is not that bad. Grace is all it needs to make it new. And grace is a simple thing. It dissolves the complexity of our duty-filled lives. Martha, dear Martha, the table of life is spread with love, simply love. Look first to see that and you will find that duty is not destroyed for you as you fear. You'll see. He also talks about somewhere. She never paid attention to her own needs either. She was blind to her own needs and serving other people.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
primary importance of time with God for their urgency to earn a living and have a living.
Any of you men want to talk about the Mary Martha struggle inside you? Thought about it long enough to.
You have to give a masculine name to
Tom and Harry. Yeah. You're Tom and Harry's inside of you. Is this a women's story? Do you men, does it click for you? If you're used to banging pots in the kitchen, I think you know it. But does it make connections for any men? I mean, it doesn't have to be serving in the kitchen. But I don't know. Last week when we were talking about Hosea, I was doing one thing and one man then described God as a wounded, wimpish husband, you know, and I was glad for that perspective because it didn't even occur to me. So I am not going to dare to say how a man would do it. You aren't either, are you?
Well, I think the text is for everybody. I think it's about being distracted and hearing the word. Okay. I see it a little differently than. And God knows I'm distracted. I don't listen to the word. I listen to Ronald Reagan, like all the rest of us do. Why we didn't impeach him when he invaded Grenada? We care. We go ahead and do that. He bombs Libya. He gets the highest popularity he's had in his whole administration. I'm not listening to the word of Jesus. I listen somewhere else. I'm distracted. So I see the thing go a little differently than the banging pots and pans. I try to bang pots and pans too now and then, but it doesn't seem to be the focus. The way I read the text.
Okay. Any other?
There must be an awful lot of Mary Martha's in business because there's any work has to be done in the church to the women who are doing it because they're not in business. It's pretty easy. If there's some job that I want to do, like the thing in the day at the church, I can kind of help you do it. It's very easy.
Okay.
I don't think the story is really about feminism or feminist issues at all.
I don't either.
I think it's really about somebody trying to tell somebody else what to do, hurry up and get it done kind of thing. And the Good Samaritan story to me doesn't mean much except for the fact that it was told to answer a question about neighborhood or loving neighbor as oneself. Mm-hmm. And I guess if one loves a neighbor as oneself, you're not about the business of trying to tell them how to live their life. So that's kind of what resonates for me.
Hmm.
Yeah. Now, what's the big to do in that Good Samaritan story about the difference between the Jew and the Samaritan? That looks like they're trying to set it up as a national thing or a group thing rather than an individual thing. Isn't this story point blank saying, it was a Samaritan? It makes this contrast that they were enemies. I don't remember the text exactly.
Well, it doesn't, the story Jesus tells doesn't explain that the Samaritans and Jews hated each other, but they did, and I think the Jews had kind of a superior notion that they had more of the revealed law or something.
The Samaritans, they each had superior views about the other, because the Samaritans
about themselves.
Held to the Pentateuch, the original five books, whereas the Jews had added on all the Apocrypha, and the Samaritans stuck with the real core material. So that's where the Samaritans would have looked at the Jews. And I don't know what the turnabout would have been, but the Jews certainly had that same superior standing in their own eyes, at least against the Samaritans. So,
well, if it's a group thing, if it is a group reaction, the Samaritans and the Jews, that's what that's playing on. Then in our day, it would be the parable of the good Soviet.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Good communist.
Yeah. Assuming that you're a capitalist, I think socialist.
Well, for us to hear it.
It might dull it for a socialist, and a socialist maybe needs to even find some. I mean, you know what I'm saying? That socialists, I think, are a little more in sympathy with Soviets than capitalists in our country. Wouldn't you say so? I mean, I guess I think you got to find the person you hate the most,
right,
or distrust the most, whoever that is. You know, for some Americans, that would not be a Russian, I don't think, or Soviet.
Well, you probably have a pretty good shot in the dark, though, I think.
Well, all right, I'll go with what you're going to say.
Yeah. And so then what impedes us to see the Soviet as good?
Mm-hmm.
The doctrine of deterrence. And it's better red, better dead than red. right?
Okay.
Now, I read that text that way once and preached on it, about lost my job.
You probably
had... I saw that parable begins the doctrine of deterrence, that the way you deal with your enemy is to scare the bejeebers out of them and get all these missiles pointed at him. And that'll deter his behavior, see? I mean, Caspar Weinberger says, look, it's worked for 40 years. This parable is saying that doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Basically saying any two people that there's a wall between.
Yeah.
You know, divorced couple.
Yeah. I wonder if the Samaritan maybe wasn't even more repulsive to a guy who was really a lawyer, who was schooled in the law. He wasn't like our attorneys. He was in the Jewish law. And so probably even had a more superior opinion of himself over against the Samaritans, I'm thinking. But I think it was a group thing, too. But yet with individual differences. I mean, the person that I would most hate to be rescued by may not be yours.
I think that's the point of the story, is that really the Jewish lawyer was the one who sat around and asked the question, who's my neighbor? You have to justify himself by the law. You can't do that.
That's right.
So Jesus tells a story that exaggerates in cartoons, in as large a picture as you possibly can, that no matter when you've done the best and the finest for your neighbor, you still haven't done everything that the law requires.
That's right.
And finally, the only way you get this resolved is that you do your best and you do it through faith, and you have to be forgiven even when you've done your best.
Yeah, yeah. And always keep asking, who is my neighbor?
Right.
You know, that continually needs to be redefined. And it may not, in a given situation, be somebody who's in the ditch, but it might be in another situation. So, anyway, it's 10. Tomorrow I do junk theology, working off an Ecclesiastes passage and doing some of Luke's Sabbath stories with Jesus.